there's a language and there's a vernacular of what is authentic and what is genuine and also what we're familiar with. And so when I think about the People's Buzz, there was a part of me that made the word People's feel a little bit like Coca-Cola because we know Coca-Cola. But how do we begin to take some of those things back?
Hello, and welcome to the Emergent Strategy Podcast, hosted by the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute. We are a collective of facilitators, mediators, and trainers, and curious human beings interested in how we get in right relationship with change. Today, I will be guiding our interview. I'm Adrian, the writer in residence here at the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute. And just as a gentle reminder, emergent strategy is the way we generate and reshape complex systems and patterns with relatively simple interactions. And one announcement to make is we are in our fifth year of emergent strategy being in the world. It came out in 2017 and it has gone places we didn't expect. And it's so exciting to be doing the podcast this year where we get to really see how far has this gone? Who has it touched? Who has it reached? And the person we have as a guest today, I'm really excited about because I met this person on Instagram in my DMs, hearing about an amazing project that they were doing. And it blew my mind so much that I was like, okay, we have to have you on the podcast. We have to hear all about this. So today, our guest is Yasmani Arboleda. And Yasmani is part of the team of the People's Bus and the Ice Cream Truck of Rights, as well as being the writer in residence at the New York City Civic Engagement Commission and part of the Community Arts Network. Did I get all that right, Yasmani?
That's right.
Okay. Well, first of all, we like to just check in. How are you doing right now today?
I am moving through expansive spaces in my personal life and in my work. I feel like there is so much that's happening in the world and there's so much change that's occurring that I feel like I'm in that change even as I move through this conversation with you this morning.
Oh, wow. That's big.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's big. That's sweet. I'm trying to think of how I'm doing. I'm trying to feel how I'm doing. I've been moving through a lot of grief and sadness lately, and it's not my usual state. You know, for the most part, I don't avoid it, but it just doesn't stick. You know, like I move through it, it flows through me, it keeps going. And I've been in this tender place where it's not flowing quickly. It's moving very slowly through me. And I am moved to tears much more often than usual. I feel like I'm just kind of sitting with the state of the world in a more tender way, in a more maybe honest way than I always do. So that's where I've been at. And this week, my partner was targeted by right-wing folks for being queer, for being a queer teacher. So I'm feeling this deep sadness about that kind of homophobia that it's like, oh, this is still so active and so violent, you know, that people will target and go after someone who's just really earnestly being themselves. So I'm feeling that tenderness and it makes me feel even more grateful for like, what are the other spaces and other ways we get to create in the world? Because I'm like, you know, they may be small, they may be many, you know, many small experiments, but I think those small experiments matter so much. Uh-huh. So I'm sitting with that. And, you know, it's part of why I'm geeked to talk to you, because when you reached out to me with, you know, we've got this amazing bus and this ice cream truck and all of it, you know, what I saw was adaptation. What I saw was small is all, you know, and what I saw was really transformative justice, you know, taking things that have been used for punishment and harm and being part of that system and actually repurposing them for joy, celebration, and community. So we are like, y'all are emergent strategists. What you're doing is emergent strategy. And, you know, we always like to ask people first, do you accept that premise? Yeah.
Well, I absolutely do. But one of the things that I'm really interested in being in dialogue with you about today is that as the artist in residence for the Civic Engagement Commission in New York City, it is within the state that I am orchestrating and crafting and collaborating with these folks. And I think so often when we think about the government or the state, I think it's a disservice to all of us to think about it as monolithic. Exactly. More than ever, there's like 8 staff members who work for the Civic Engagement Commission. And when I showed up last summer, it was those 8 individuals that I was in relation to. And so when folks, there's moments in which people have questioned, well, how are you changing democracy? And I say, well, I show up and have conversation with folk who work within these systems every day. And in showing up and being myself in that process, I am altering the way they think, the way they approach process, the way they allow themselves to, the places they allow themselves to go with the work.
Ah, that makes sense. And so the bus and the truck are part of the commission?
So as the artist in residence for the Civic Engagement Commission, which is a program that actually begins in spirit in 1977 with the artist Merle Eukiles Lederman, who volunteered in the Department of Sanitation as their artist in residence. And back in 1977, her belief was that shaking the hands of more than 800 sanitation workers and telling them that their work mattered and that their work made New York City possible was like, that was her work. Eventually,
oh, wow.
I mean, how incredible, right? Back 4 or 5 decades ago, somebody was thinking about art as care, and that kind of the simple gesture of shaking someone's hand and looking at them in the eye and saying, hey, you matter. And the work you're doing with picking up garbage matters. And it is integral to our process of what a city is. I don't know. And so the brilliant Tom Finkelpearl in 2015 says, let's take that and create the Public Artist in Residence program, which then begins to embed artists in different city agencies. And the idea is that these artists will transform those city agencies through their work. And I think that's valuable because so often we think, oh, artists, it's the painting, it's mural, it's sculpture. Absolutely. But in the way that I think about it, I think that there should be artists in residence everywhere actually engaging with the transformation of infrastructure. And so bringing that beauty and joy and making it a priority in our process changes things. And so when I showed up at the Civic Engagement Commission, I think it's important that folks know the Civic Engagement Commission was just created in 2018 in New York City. It is the only agency that has a direct mandate. It's in the law that its job is to build trust in our democracy. And so when I show up and I'm like, most folks have no idea this agency exists and that it's supposed to be doing this. How can it do its work if it's meant to be doing it in collaboration? Yeah. And so immediately I'm like, I begin thinking, what is the storytelling tradition of the Civic Engagement Commission in New York City?
Wow.
What an immense, what an expansive ask and what a way of approaching the entry point. And so I understood even with the 8 staff members that when we talk about who's a liberal and who's a conservative, oh my goodness. Again, like the variations of what that means and how each of us use that language. And so it really begins with centering values. What are the values of this agency? What is this agency supposed to be doing in its work? And I'll tell you, it's got three specific projects that it's supposed to be delivering to the residents of New York. And it's language access, having translators at polling sites so that folks who don't speak English can vote and participate in our democracy. It is supporting a citywide participatory budgeting process, which puts money in the hands of residents and gets us all to vote and participate in how money is used, and then supporting our community boards. And that's critical because when I think about community boards, I often think about a person in the front, sitting in a classroom in front of it, and everybody's just listening to a singular person speak about a particular idea. And from the very beginning, I'm like, where is the music? Talking, where is our dancing? Yeah. Where is the food so we can break bread before we make decisions together?
Yes.
It changes things.
How does this become a community space, not just a serving community? Yes.
And so from the very beginning, from the very beginning, it's like civic engagement. When you translate Civic Engagement Commission into the 11 official languages of New York City, you get lost. You totally, literally when you're translating it into all these languages, how are we connecting with the people we're supposed to be serving if their primary language is not English? Mm. And so I was like, given what I've read and what I've heard, we're the People's Commission. Can we change the name? They were like, no, we're going to have a public hearing. and we have to bring our lawyers in, because do the people want us to become the People's Commission?
Yeah.
And so, like, even the question of language, what is the language we use to invite folks to participate? If our name is complicated, are we really doing the work of transforming ourselves to serve the folks
that's
we
right.
need to be serving?
Ooh.
So, a lot.
There's a lot there. And so then how do you get from there to the People's Bus and the Ice Cream Truck of Rights? And what are those projects? Can you tell people who maybe haven't seen the beautiful pictures and read about it?
Yeah, and I think it's important people hear that for the first 6 months, I was on Zoom with the 8 staff members of the agency.
Wow.
So we weren't seeing each other in person, right? It begins in the summer. I began working at the agency as the artist in residence in August of 2020.
Oh.
And so it's not until February of 2021 that I meet in person any of the staff members of the agency. One of the things that happens is that I'm iterative and I'm experimental and we're trying things. I always think of my drawings not as a pencil meeting a piece of paper, but as a drawing into a conversation. Mm. I'm like, let's brainstorm together. Who are we here and how do we make ourselves manifest?
Mm.
And so at first I was thinking, gosh, do we change the name? How do we get easy on connecting to our residents? And then I started thinking, can we be the Listening Commission?
Mm.
Can we be the Transformation Commission? And I began ideating, creating possibilities for projects. One of them was the People's Way, which was, can we work with the Department of Transportation to create a new public signage system in public space that orients us inward? Right? So that we have signage, like, can we meditate or take moments to reflect on the sky 5 times a day? And can there be signage in public space that brings us into that mental health, that awareness, that our capacity to reflect is important daily? I began thinking about, can we create a people's orientation? Like when you go to college, like for all of us in the entire city of New York to get oriented again,
mm-hmm.
we are so disoriented by all of the things that have been changing around us.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make space to like understand all that change?
Mm.
And then eventually in not getting traction with any of these ideas, I was like, what do? I literally had 8 staff members. I invited them to put on sweats and to spend 2 hours with me in front of their computers.
Mm.
I invited them to like stand up in front of their computers with their cameras on. And I said, let's imagine we're at the park and we're jogging together. Because if we were physically in space, I would be making them do all kinds of wacky movements. That the weirdness of moving weirdly together, dancing, mimicking different types of animals,
yeah.
things like that, make us silly with each other,
yeah.
which gives us space to actually reimagine who we are together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to them, let's imagine that at that park, we are meeting my mother, who has been in the United States for 3 decades. And let's imagine uh-huh. that we're meeting my nephew, Escher, who's 6 years old and speaks Spanish, English, and Mandarin, and a little bit of sign language. And him as a 6-year-old, her as a 67-year-old woman, who would tell you she doesn't speak English, even though she's been here for 3 decades. What would you tell them about who we are at the Civic Engagement Commission? And each of them answered, and I had them reflect and write it down. And Leslie Brown, our chief of staff, said, democracy is a table where our elders show up with their wisdom and our youth shows up with their dreams. And it's a conversation. And that got me to thinking, gosh, it's about mobility. The Civic Engagement Commission has to meet people where they are. And because I've been working with youth from all over New York City towards the integration of our public schools, I was like, maybe it's a yellow school bus that we transform into a community center that brings resources.
Yeah.
Eventually, we met with the Department of Procurement, the city's procurement, DCAS as it's known, and they said, actually, your yellow school bus is a great idea, but we don't actually own those. Those are privately contracted. We do have a slew of other vehicles that are a possibility, and one of those vehicles was a corrections bus.
Wow.
And I said, oh my goodness, how incredible that in this moment, we can write a poem where we take a bus literally from Rikers Island that was used for 12 years. It was used from 2009 and 2021
wow.
as a corrections bus to transport people who were imprisoned by the system. And how do we take that and transform it into a vehicle for healing and education? And
wow.
I made my drawings of the possibility of what this bus could do. Could it be a stage so that it's a theater that tells stories? Can it be a podcasting station that collects narratives? How do we use the bus to celebrate resilience? And then I began to tell the story of the possibility of this thing. At first, we thought it wasn't going to be possible because they were going to be the agency actually thought that the Department of Corrections wouldn't be interested in supporting something like this. But with my drawings and with my optimism, I showed up and kind of shared the story of what we could do. And then they got excited and they were like, yeah, we do have retired buses that could do this. And we got a bus on June 4th, 2021. We got a corrections bus out of Rikers. And it was just a week later that we took that bus all over New York City, asking New York City residents what they wanted the bus to become. Here's what was beautiful from the very beginning, that I'm a collaborator. And so I bring in territorial empathy and Sarif Pineda to help us with the architectural transformation.
Wait, slow that down. Slow that down. You said you bring in territorial empathy.
Yeah, it's an organization of designers and architects in Brooklyn who work together with communities to develop new ways of building space and connecting meaningfully with each other.
Wow. Okay. And then what was the other thing you said?
Mujeres en Movimiento, who is a group of women who gather three times a week in Corona Park in Queens. And what they believe is that by gathering and moving together, they're changing each other and empowering each other towards the future that takes care of all people.
Wow.
And those women are amazing. They've been an organization, an informal organization, for 9 years. And when I met them earlier this year in March, I said, here's the idea. You know what was incredible, Adrienne? That when I showed up and showed them a picture of the bus in Queens, those women gather in Corona Park, and I had never been to the part of the park where they gather. And the drawing that I had made of the bus was from that specific spot.
What?
So the drawing that I created was in November, and then I showed up in March, and literally I have it here in my studio. And it's miraculous to me that it was kind of a projection of the future, that those women would show up and actually craft that 1.8 million bead ceiling was made by these mujeres who are incredible craftswomen.
Wow.
And spent 3 months building an 8.8 million mural that's now in the interior of the bus.
Yes, the ceiling of the bus is a mural made out of beads that is like Sistine Chapel level, like just this absolutely gorgeous, glorious thing. I mean, it floored me as a piece of art, but also knowing that it was this collaborative effort to create it.
Yeah, the beads are recycled. They come from Materials for the Arts, which is an organization in Queens also that recycles more than 5 tons of materials a year. They take, and so all of these beads came from all of the stores, the bead stores in Manhattan that closed during the pandemic. And we use many of them. There's still many here, and we're still crafting different types of things with those beads. But creativity and imagination, how can that be a resource for all of us to reinvent, to rethink, to reconsider what is possible?
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. And then the ice cream truck of rights.
And so the ice cream truck of rights in parallel comes with Carolina Rubio McBride, who is a lawyer and artist who was based in Brooklyn, now in New Jersey, and are thinking of how do we make rights accessible. And so when we think about the People's Bus, eventually led to the People's Festival. And so we transformed the corrections vehicle into a vehicle for healing. And now it is really a stage that brings dance, food, performance of many kinds. We've had incredible DJs and incredible groups, actually. Like our last performance was at El Museo a couple of weeks ago, where we had indigenous groups from Mexico perform healing dances for the earth, welcoming the winter. And so, again, how do we center connection and relationship and bring resources to these communities? What eventually happens is that we center the tour of the People's Bus around the 33 neighborhoods that were hardest hit by COVID. Those neighborhoods actually have the lowest number of registered voters and the highest number of folks getting evicted right now. And so when we think as a Civic Engagement Commission, how do we bring resources to these places? But how do we do so while celebrating the fact that we're still here? The fact that we're still creating and building meaning together, and that this bus is now a vehicle for transformation. I'm often with the work, I'm often thinking, how are we building spaces, gyms for the human imagination, where we can exercise our creativity, right?
Yes.
So I think, you know, it's one of the most valuable aspects of being able to envision together.
Yeah. So you have such a bursting of energy. Like I can feel the inevitability of your success, you know, like when you're like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I would love to know what your political lineage is. Like what shaped your outlook? What shaped your imagination?
Yeah, when you ask me about my political lineage, it is important for me to name that when I was 11 years old, my father was assassinated in Colombia, in Medellin.
Wow.
And two of my uncles were tortured to death.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Within the same couple of weeks.
Oh, wow.
And then we have to hide out in the mountains of in the Andes mountains outside of Medellin for a couple of months because my mother had to go to the capital, to Bogota, to get asylum, to seek asylum, so that even though me and my younger sister were born in the United States, we went back to Colombia when I was 4 years old. And so that journey, and actually, let me go back a little bit further. my political lineage comes from the fact that when my mother came to the United States for the first time, she traveled to Tijuana, Mexico on a plane, and then she walked north, sunbathing. For 12 hours, she would sunbathe, and then she would walk north, and she was pregnant with me. And so I always talk about me being an artist, because she was pregnant with me in that moment, her imagining the beauty of sunbathing and walking north.
Oh, wow.
And what does it mean to cross borders you're not supposed to cross?
Yes.
And so when I think about that beginning, these two moments really influence the way that I think and the way that I approach my work.
Wow.
As an artist, I am always seeking to create spaces for belonging where pluralism and multiplicity are the most treasured aspects of what brings us together.
Yeah. So you're 11 years old. You're living in the mountains. Your mother gets asylum. You come back to the U.S. I imagine that art was a major part of your grief process as well.
Yeah. But I have to say it was interesting coming back to the United States and living in South Florida.
South Florida.
I remember, in Fort Lauderdale, I went to school in Deerfield Beach. And I, as a little queer person moving through the world at that time, I will tell you that I remember the pain of people calling me Pedro, because Pedro was the man who was on national television living with AIDS in the real world, right? And so my peers, when they would hear me speak, my accent was similar to his accent. And so for a very long time, I was very afraid of my own voice.
Pedro. I'm like, I remember that. I'm like speaking the edge of my brain.
Yeah,
you know how stuff just, you're like, oh, wait, I remember. Yeah. Thank you. You just lit up some synapse over in my brain. I remember that.
Yeah. And, you know, he met with the president at the time, and he was what we thought of as HIV and AIDS and me being a Latino person again, like that, it was painful, but it was also a recognition of like what I, questioning of what I was,
and were you out?
How I identified. Yeah. No, well, so at that time I was like, you know, 15 years old, and I come from a deeply Catholic family, very deeply religious. I have to say that I often think about poverty beyond finances. I always think about poverty being something that is in the mind.
Oh,
and so when I think about lack of resource, I think about the religious folk who can only see in one way I just think about the way that I was raised within my family and the fear that was put in me for who I was. And I'll tell you too, when I think about your partner and what's happened this week, I think about that idea that I was told that I was an abomination by the people that raised me and by the community that I was a part of, and how hurtful that was. And so how much of my life has been the undoing of through these art projects that are about color and that are about celebration of the unknown and that which we have yet to understand.
Oh, I love that. there's so much there. And I'm always curious, you know, as a writer myself, you know, like I see myself as an artist. I see myself as a creator. You know, from a very young age, I was drawing and writing and telling stories. But it took a long time for me to claim it as like, this is actually my calling, you know. And particularly to be an artist in service of humanity, you know, an artist who's like, I'm trying to make the world a more beautiful, peaceful, you know, just liberatory space. And I'm trying to infuse love into my work. I feel like it took a long time, you know, like it's just in this past few years that I feel like I'm like, okay, this is my job. I'm curious for you, you know, like, when did you start creating? Like, when was the art like there? And then when did you claim like, this is what I'm doing?
Yeah. You know, it's tough for all of us to like really own that artist part of ourselves. And I think, you know, when I think about, our culture and the spaces we inhabit, I think that people are often like, oh, what is the role of the artist in society? I'm like, no, what is the role of the artist in ourselves?
Inside
of ourselves, each of us crafting and creating the possibility of tomorrow. And it took a long time because there was, because I come from a very conservative Catholic family, I went to study architecture. I did not believe that I could study art and that could be a thing that I could devote myself to, even though I was already crafting and photographing and making paintings. All of those things were often in service of other things. And so eventually when I moved to New York City, I remember the first couple of years showing up and actually saying the words, I'm an artist. And the shame in that, the real shame that I could feel in myself being like, oh my gosh, can I really say that? Is that true? Can I own it? And now more than ever, because I understand that I'm a moving experiment all of the time.
Yes.
I honor that and I treasure it. And I invite everybody to treasure it through the work that we do, right? In my mind, when I think about the Public Artist in Residence program, I think how beautiful, but can we actually give people actual line items with real budgets that actually can support change? Because I'll tell you, even with the creation of the program, Tom Finkelpearl was using a micro purchase. And so he said the Department of Culture can give $20,000 and another agency can give $20,000 and the artist will get paid $20,000 for 1 year of work. And the other 20,000 will go towards the work, right? To the making of the project. But I'll tell you that in my working of the People's Buzz and the creation of the Ice Cream Truck of Rights, that was the beginning. That was like the little EDCD, the seed of the thing. I actually was able to fundraise $500,000 to be able to pay. We've paid more than 500 people to participate in all aspects of the creation of the work. Because again, one of the critical aspects of this, and I'll tell you, another part of the miracle was that Mujeres en Movimiento, some of those women don't have the paperwork to be able to vote in this city. And they showed up to teach people how to ranked choice vote in June. So when we asked New Yorkers what they wanted the People's Bus to become, we were asking them five choices. And we actually had a ranked choice voting ballot so that they could practice the way they were going to be voting for mayor a couple of weeks later.
Wow.
Right. And like, when I think about those women who don't have the power to vote, teaching others how to vote, how miraculous.
Yes. So then it's like it keeps unfolding itself. It's like, you know, the journey, it's like you're self-discovering and self-creating. And, you know, one of the questions we always ask people is, what are you practicing? You know, like you're telling us a lot about collaboration and connecting people. You know, what do you feel like on a daily basis you're practicing that is bringing emergent strategy into how you move, how you think?
I have to say there's a huge part of this that has to do with the practice of humility. Of the not knowing, of leaving space for those unknowns so that they could actually inform all the different aspects. I always think about it like funky furniture. If you think about a room and the furniture that makes it up, I think about the colors, the shapes. All the fonts. Can we use many fonts? Because everybody's invited. The more we can show variation in any different type of amalgamation of units, the more power there is, right? The more perspectives. And so, again, the thinking through. With every one of my projects, people always ask, oh, what is the impact? How do you measure impact?
Yeah.
And I always say, well, it's people got to know each other. They got to know each other, and they got to be in a process of reinvention where we talked about impossible things and then we made them happen. And in that process, we learned how to fundraise, how to find the money we needed to make the things possible. We learned how to storytell. So we learned how to make, you know, how to build narrative and share with each other. I often also think about the idea of democracy. And I'm like, what is the flavor of democracy? Is it honey?
Yeah.
So that it's sticky and sweet.
Yes.
So that we're inviting folks to participate in a rejoicing and in a recognition that like, that it is about mirroring, it's about witnessing, it's about, I don't know.
Yeah, I like that.
And so that practicing humility, practicing optimism, I think that's another aspect of the work that's really critical, is the possibility for, yes, there's challenges and there's things that are going to come, you know, that are going to get in the way of this work. But how do we find variation and possibility around those challenges? Yeah. And how do we name that together so that we can be in a practice of reflection with each other?
I appreciate that. And I also think, you know, there's something around sovereignty that comes in. So you're practicing and then you're engaging with the state and city government to move. So, you know, maybe the question is, are there ways that emergent strategy is helping you to maintain your sovereignty and that of your vision as you navigate the state city government space?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. At the very beginning of this work, we built a contract for my public artist in residence work, the role. And I remember in that conversation, they asked the question of like, what is the city going to own at the end of the practice or when we're done with this contract? And I was clearly able to say the most valuable aspect of this work that is not ownable is all of the relationships that will be built through this process. And I don't know how you name that in the contract, but I have to say that me, it's not ownable. It doesn't. And so I think with emergent strategy, there's so much about that being nimble and flexible and iterative that really, you know, at one point I wanted to make us t-shirts that said we were prototyping in public, right? We're experimenting, we're trying things and allowing, again, for the unknowns. But it's really hard, I'll tell you. It's really challenging with folks who want to have contracts that are rigid, that speak about what is owned by who and for what, how long, all of these things that have to do with output and production that I have to say, it's part of our process, but it's not the center of our process.
It's not the center of the process. And people respond positively because of the quality of the work, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really beautiful about the practice that I've built over the past 20 years is that there's a commitment to the craftsmanship and to a singular vision that is really an expression of multiplicity. I don't know if that.
Yes,
I just think it's because I think often people think of community projects as collage or like hodgepodge, and I'm like, no. Community vision, collective visioning that is built through community can be stunningly beautiful, and it's about allowing the nature of the folks who are showing up to do the work to really be true.
You know, they call me the Night Queen, 'cause I live in the dark.
And, you know, you made this journey here from Colombia. There's something I'm curious about, which is why New York City as the place where you were rooting your experimental work? Has there been any longing to do that work internationally? Have you done that work internationally?
Yes.
Has there been, we think about place and like, you know, I'm one of these people. I'm like, oh, yeah, like, where am I rooting? And then I move. I'm a displaced person, intergenerationally displaced, and then in life moved many, many, many times. And, you know, I'm always in that question of like, where do I want to throw my magic, you know? And so I'm curious about that for you.
You know, since I was a very young person, I always was moving towards New York City, and it was a thing about the multiplicity of here, all of the languages that are spoken here, all of the ways, but also the amount of how culture is produced here and exported to everywhere else in the world. But I will tell you that over the past 20 years, I've lived and worked in India, where I began a project called Monday Morning, where we give away 10,000 balloons of a single color to people who are going back to work on Monday morning. And we've done that, we've given away orange balloons in India, green balloons in Japan, in Yamaguchi, yellow balloons in Kenya, where we then in Nairobi began the project Coloring Faith, where over the past 8 years we've painted 16 houses of worship yellow in the name of love. mosques, temples, and churches, and communities gathering to paint those buildings yellow and to think about these buildings as sculptures that speak to our common humanity, but that are really honoring our humanity. All of the people who show up and do the work, not only are they collaborating, they're getting to know each other. What do we eat on Sundays after church? Where do we go shopping? Literally, there's neighborhoods in Kibera and in Mombasa where you have a yellow church and a yellow mosque, and they become playgrounds for children because they feel safe, and so they go and hang out there all the time.
Yes.
I think about the work we've done in South Africa, in Johannesburg, with artists there, where we did a project called Beware of Color, where we poured Johannesburg pink, down the windows and the rooftops of abandoned buildings in downtown Johannesburg to call attention to the buildings that are still owned post-apartheid by white folks who live in the suburbs, who have left behind these buildings who could be used for people for work and for living and that are empty. And so, again, highlighting literally these buildings to call attention to systems that should be disrupted and that should transform to take care of the people who are actually living on the outside of them.
See, I love this. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, with the podcast, like there's always a mixture of like people we know very well. And then people is like, I don't know, you know, this is going to be a journey of discovery for me. And I'm having such an exciting moment because I'm like, the projects that you've been doing really align with so many of the projects that have excited me in other places, you know, like I think in Detroit about the Heidelberg project, you know, Tyree Guyton. And like, I'm like, yes, that's it. Like, you know, painting and deploying color and deploying, as you keep saying, the multiplicity, you know, bringing in the beauty and the complexity of the actual vibrant and living world and creating spaces where people have to deal with each other, be with each other, build with each other, like experience intimacy in a way that's not combative.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I've spent time in Elaine, Arkansas, in Phillips County, where we've been working on a project. The collective's name is Remember 2019. And it began, I don't know, almost a decade ago now. And the idea was, how do we memorialize and how do we create monument for the massacre that happened in Elaine, Arkansas in 1919, where more than 200 folks were killed in a church because they wanted more money for their cotton, right? Mauricio Tafur Salgado, one of my dear friends and collaborators, hears Brian Stevenson ask the question, what is to memorialize all of the massacres and all of the places where folks have been killed? And it's so, and he calls me and he says, how do we memorialize? Can we go to Elaine? What do we do? And the idea really began by thinking, can we invest on the cultural producers of these spaces, of these communities as monument? We've spent now more than 8 years collaborating with folks in Phillips County, and we've built an archive of audio histories, more than 100 of them, to honor because the 2019 was a centennial, and so for us was, what is the monument we build?
That's right.
Over the pandemic, we created a book called Black Cypress, which is a Phillips County survival guide that includes recipes and stories of the people of this community. And we paid all of them to participate in the crafting of this book. But again, how do we invest in people as monuments? How do we really engage? And again, even with the work with the People's Buzz in the Ice Cream Truck of Rights, it's always around, how do we bring people together in the name of creativity and transformation? More than ever, we should have chief transformation officers in all of our communities, in all of our companies, in all of our spaces.
Yes, I deeply agree.
and in my mind, it's the role of art to bring artists into these spaces with these kinds of titles where they're being paid money to actually invest and care for the transformation of any given set of people.
Yeah.
So critical in this moment.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think there's also a piece that's emerging to me now, you know, and I'm curious, this is a real, you know, I'm curious to hear what you think about this, because I really feel like art can be used in so many ways and it can be used to uphold the status quo, you know? And I always feel cautious about this as a creator, you know, it's like, as I'm creating, am I inviting people towards something new? Am I inviting people towards something familiar? Am I inviting people towards something kind of, all, you know, all of it, right? I wonder if you think about that, or if you, you know, like what feels like your relationship between your art and the politics?
It's so interesting, and I really appreciate you pulling me towards that space, because it is complex, right? And there's a lot of tensions that I welcome in my humility. I welcome all of these tensions into the process.
Yeah.
What is a different way of entering that question?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things I'm always thinking about, I'm really sitting in a post-nationalist frame in a lot of my thinking these days, right? Is that I'm like, we need to find ways to practice with each other, you know, democracy, small d democracy, and collaboration and community. And we have to be really careful about it, the state, you know, that the state is constantly co-opting our creativity and our life force, you know, for its own mechanisms. And I feel like you're riding this line, you know, of finding out like how, you know, I don't want to say how to make the state work against itself. It's not that. It's really like, you know, this engagement of people in what they can do now, you know, like it feels very present.
Uh-huh.
Does that resonate?
Completely, because I'll tell you, in my work with the city of New York, it's been really challenging. You recognize over the past year, I recognize, but even with museums, right? Yes. Museums plan exhibitions years ahead of time.
Yes.
I also think, I mean, come on, how obsolete are museums? Can we please recognize that they're not meant to be responsive? And if a system is not meant to be responsive, what is the system doing?
Exactly.
And so I'll tell you, within the government, it's been there's been aspects of it that have been so wary, like that have warned me, because we talked for months and months and months. You know, I'll give you one example, which is we talked about whether or not to say it was a corrections vehicle in the way we talked about the bus, the people's bus.
Right.
Is it a corrections vehicle or is it a retired city vehicle?
Ah.
And I kept saying, but isn't it a correction? Wasn't it used? I mean, like, isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
And it wasn't about the truth or not. It was about the framing of it and its optics.
Exactly.
And so, and like, so important for me that it was a corrections vehicle from the very beginning.
Yes.
And for me, it was like, well, can we just call it what it is?
Yeah.
But what it is, again, with the question of Civic Engagement Commission, the language, what is it? Do we agree on what those words mean?
Right.
And that tension has been present the entire time. And I think it's an important thing that we should invite into all parts of the work.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is my thing. You know, I feel like there's folks who can be like, well, I just walk away or I don't, you know, like I hold the line this way. And then I stay curious about people who are like, I'm holding the line, but I'm holding it while in direct contact. I'm holding it, you know, from a different positionality. Right.
Yeah. But another aspect that I think I'm very conscious of as I do the work that I do is there's a language and there's a vernacular of what is authentic and what is genuine and also what we're familiar with. And so when I think that's about the people's bus, there was a part of me that made the word people's feel a little bit like Coca-Cola because we know Coca-Cola, but how do we begin to take some of those things back and play with the systems that we understand to create a familiarity that allows us a shorthand. And I recognize the dangers that we're naming, but I also think it's important to be in the experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing, you know, to me, I'm like, I think there's something, I don't think we talk enough about the fact that a lot of art ends up in the realm of co-optation, in the realm of museums, in the realm of the very wealthy. A lot of, you know, what we get to imagine then gets held by those forces. And then when we're like, actually, I want to reclaim this, we can reclaim this and we can use art as a way to reclaim our own voice or reclaim these conversations. But part of what you're making me think of, you know, Octavia E. Butler has this quote, all that you touch, you change, and all that you change, changes you. And, you know, I've noticed that in my more recent life, I haven't been open to being changed by everyone, right? And I avoid spaces sometimes where I'm like, oh, I know the person here would want to change me to be more conservative, perhaps more mainstream. You know, I'm like, no, thank you. I'm only available to become more radical. But I wonder about that too. That's like, is that my own limitation? As an artist, do I need to keep myself in relationships where, like you are, right? Where you're like, I'm sitting here with you trying to find a common language and not relinquishing the possibility of relationship to the socialized entrapment that we're in.
Yeah. Right? Can I share another story that I think you'll appreciate? Because it brings me to that complexity, which is, as part of the People's Buzz, from the very beginning, it was important for me to create a youth program or a youth component where we had young people participating in the decision-making process of the People's Buzz in the festival. So we brought in 30 young people making $18 an hour for a summer program for 3 months. The executive director, the youth executive director, was Emma Rehak, an incredible youth activist here in New York City. And from the very beginning, we were in tension because many of the youth that showed up think of themselves as abolitionists.
Yes.
And it was beautiful. And I have thought of myself as an abolitionist for a very long time. But I think working within the city of New York, I began to understand that when we talk about abolish the police within the government, there's a disservice there. And I have to tell you that working with the youth, I continuously felt like, am I selling out? Like, am I letting go of principles and ideas that I ascribe to? But to be very honest with you, I have to disagree, because the reality is that in New York City, 80% of people who voted this year, for example, so I'll give you the direct what happened, which was I invited them into conversation around abolish the police. Can we say it? Yes. How do we say it? How do we talk about it? And I shared with them my experience, which is that when we say those words within government, it feels a little bit silly. And why is it, does it feel silly? Because we know that 80% of Black and Brown families believe the police is important. And so the parents of these youth are voting for a mayor or are engaging with ideas of the police actually is a necessary aspect of our society. And so I always invite myself to think about transformation. Can we transform the police? Those are people, right? I think about the example of Antanas Mockus, who was the mayor of Bogota in Colombia in the 90s. And I don't know if you know, but he took 2,000, he took traffic police, 2,000 of them, and he offered them the possibility to be rehired as mimes, to work as mimes to fix traffic in Bogota. And literally, like 50% of traffic got fixed because we had mimes in public space instead of traffic police. And so
I didn't know
Antanas Mockus, incredible. Like, what brilliant way to like undo and reset and you know, reconsider what traffic and people and public safety looks like, right? I'm a keeper of the moon, and she'll never be
more. Revelations coming true. Blowing smoke rings in the dark. I held on to only you. Right. Well, I mean, it also makes me think about, you know, in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, I recently got to support the Yes on Two campaign, and their campaign was, we're trying to say we want to transition from a police department to a department of public safety, and that there's a transition plan inside of that. Like, it's like the human, there's a plan for the humans to transition inside of that. And it was interesting to sit in the conversation with them and be like, oh, language wise, right? There's places where it makes sense to be like, abolish it all, defund the police, everything. And they were like, but here it sounds similar, right? Strategically, it was just like, people are not in a place where they feel safe enough to truly consider and imagine abolishing the police. Like, that's still the organizing and imagination work we have to do, is be like, here's what public safety would actually look like and entail. And there's a lot of jobs inside of public safety. And what does it look like to invite people's imagination into that space?
Yeah, because of course there's millions of people who identify as police family, even with the army. I think about all those folks who are like, I've been thinking a lot about nationalism and like how we, Americans, right? Like this, how we brand ourselves. Even actually this weekend, I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times around the French leaders who are saying that the new pronoun that was admitted by the Robert, one of their new dictionaries, one of their most respected dictionaries, is saying that the pronoun that is non-binary is coming into the world. It's Yale, and it is beautiful, and it is important because it validates different ways of being. And French aristocracy is up in arms saying, absolutely not, our language is precious, and it is finite, and it cannot be changed. And it makes me be like, what are we doing with these leaders? Literally
every single day, the language is changing. Yeah, but I mean, I think that that's, you know, so much of what I see Emergent Strategy being up to is inviting people to imagine and practice such that it makes the current constructs obsolete. Right.
Yeah.
That it's like, you know, we feel that they are obsolete. We know that, you know, like Miriam Kaba talks about, she's like, it's not like this current system is working. We know it's not working. And so the invitation is to a different way of being. But then it's also like, if we don't practice that other way of being, it becomes even more hard to imagine. Right. Uh-huh. It's like, if all of our practice is punishment, how do we actually engage in abolition? So thank you for that dive, you know, because I was just like, I want to get into this with you. And the next question I have is actually, you know, you have all of these pieces in motion. What's emerging for you? What feels like the next experiment that you are excited about?
So I am currently in my studio, and I think
I was like, whatever is this gorgeous space?
So I actually painted this octopus as part of imagining New York City as an octopus. Like, what is New York City if it is an octopus? And one of the paintings that I worked on during the pandemic in my little apartment in New York City was the ocean, right? Like the waves of the ocean, seeing
That's gorgeous.
Relationships to nature. I think I grew up next to the water. And so one thing that water, even in my imaging, was important. So I share the what I'm sitting around, because in my mind, it's truly becoming the people's studio. I am really interested in creating a space where people in New York City can come together and collaborate in collective visioning. It could become the People's Institute. I'm trying to think through, like, what are the tools and the resources that we need to create spaces that can be replicated and scaled in other communities so that we can invite each other into creativity. And so that is really what I'm now beginning to move towards. When I think about the People's Festival 2.0, I think about, gosh, could we transform public spaces that are currently not considered safe through color? Can we bring the People's Buzz to different communities throughout New York City to transform space through these kinds of gestures? But really, it's about creating a permanent or a space for us to gather and use our creativity and our imagination. We can call it art, but it's really about crafting the future together.
Yeah. Wow. That's exciting. And do you have a question that you're sitting with, like a question that feels super resonant for you, that guides you?
Well, you know, from the very beginning as an artist, I've always thought about the work of my work as a leader, as a community builder. And one of the things that still sits with, that I'm still sitting with, and I'm trying to better understand, is even having this conversation with you, the People's Buzz and the People's Festival and the Ice Cream Truck of Rights was created by so many incredible people.
Right.
And so holding the power and allowing all of the people who were present, who own the work with me, to actually be able to share and show up to these kinds of conversations and be the multiplicity that I often speak about.
That's right.
That is something that I think has to be considered. And it's something that I've been in tension with, right? Because there's so many different folks who showed up and who gave so much. How do we make space for everyone to have voice and to tell story and to be inclusive in that way? So that continues to be something that I am aware of and sensitive to.
I love that. I feel like I'm in that question all the time too, is like, how do I move the way I move with an honest expression of how many people are in that movement? In every decision I make or in everything I write, it's like nourished by millions in a way. I love that. And I really appreciated this conversation with you. It's been a delight, and there's been a lot of surprises for me inside of it. And I've learned, and I'm grateful for that. Thank you, Yasmani, for...
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you for making this space to share stories and to share where I've been, that I can hopefully inform all the folks that are listening to us talk.
This podcast is produced by Natalie Peart. Music for the Emergent Strategy podcast is provided by Hooray for the Riff Raff and their album, Life on Earth. To support the ongoing work of ESII, make a donation at www.alliedmedia.org/ESII.